The views and opinions expressed by the guests, callers, and hosts on this and all Rents Radio Network programs do not necessarily reflect or agree with those of the network, its commercial sponsors, its radio station affiliates, or internet broadcast platforms. In these controversial times, we believe the First Amendment and freedom of the press are absolutely essential to the survival of our nation. Thank you. And now, enjoy the program.
Okay, and welcome back. Just had a note that the entire state of Massachusetts, which has centralized all of its 911 calling through some kind of an electronic telecommunications platform, the whole state was down. You couldn't call 911 anywhere in the state of Massachusetts for a number of hours. It's back up now, but that sounds like an attack to me. These things don't just happen. They have redundancies built in and so forth. So, interesting. Crazy times we live in. Once a month, we spend time with a number of extraordinary people, none more so than Frank Joseph, the author, researcher, who has lately, well, what we've been doing, we'll see if we're going to do it again. I'm not sure what we're going to do tonight, but we've been looking back in history at the date in history, or even the week in history, where we are today. June, what the hell is it? June 19th already. Wow. Frank, are you there?
Yes, I am.
Welcome back. I didn't get any emails from you. If you sent them, they were intercepted. So.
Oh, my gosh. Today is not the 19th. Tomorrow is the 19th. And that's
18th,
what
18th,
we may want
sorry.
To discuss tonight.
Yeah, let's talk about the 18th. First of all, how are you and what are you seeing where you are in terms of the state of what's left of this otherwise organized society? Do you notice any ragged edges? What are you seeing? I'm just curious.
Well, what I'm seeing, and I'm sure it's crystal clear to the vast majority of our listeners, and certainly to yourself who's been involved in seeing what's wrong with our country for so long, we're seeing the complete remake of everything in America. We're seeing a period we're going through which is unofficial, literally just a destruction, a dismantling of everything traditional, absolutely everything that has gone into building what this country was. We're being ground down to a zero point, and then we're going to be remade in the image of something which is completely at odds with what we've known in the past. It's a complete, extreme makeover of our civilization. And that is the reality that we're facing. And I don't suggest any answers to this. I don't even know a definite answer, but I know that telling the truth about it and fighting it to the best of our abilities and our own ways is the only thing we can do, the only thing left to us. But that's what I
see.
Right,
that's right.
Details are everywhere, yeah. From a president, a so-called president, who is unbelievable that such a creature would be allowed into the White House. It's astounding. I mean, we have been made a laughing stock throughout the world because of just for that example, that someone like that should be involved.
A good part of that belongs
in an assisted care home.
Of course he does. A good part of that, the flip side, is that we now can see unequivocally the fraud that alleged organized government is. The White House and the presidency mean nothing, and this is abject proof of it. It's all being run from other levels, all of it. It's a show. Well, this guy wouldn't be. He's not functional. Your point is extremely correct. Now, on the other side of the world, Russia, and this is a story in RT. This is very interesting. It kind of makes you sad. I mean, it's really nice, but we used to be like this. Russian school children will now be studying housekeeping, homemaking in Russia. The lessons will be part of a family studies course starting in the next academic year. A course in family studies for school children, which includes housekeeping, is set to be introduced in Russia. A newspaper reported today, the study plan will soon be distributed to schools across the country. When Putin was talking about values, he wasn't kidding. This puts us to shame even more than we already are. This is remarkable. It's all flipped
in
60, 70 years.
We used to have this in the United States also. It was called home economics. I can remember that when I went
home
to school.
You
bet. And that is, I mean, that was standard. I mean, these were just basic things that you were responsibilities that one was expected to assume to a greater degree, and that was the path to adulthood. Well,
right.
Of course, that's all thrown out. That's all trashed. What we're going through has been described long ago by a very great philosopher, one of the greatest. He was such a great philosopher, he lost his mind. He had too much thought. That's Friedrich Nietzsche. But Friedrich Nietzsche talked about the transvaluation of all values. He also talked about it as the devaluation of all values. And he saw that coming way back in the middle of the 19th century. He was really a John the Baptist. He was really a man crying in the wilderness in those days. But now it's all crystal clear. And if these things are obvious to us now, it's not because for want to hide them. It's because the people that are the psychopaths that are controlling things, they don't care anymore. They don't care whether they're exposed or not because they're just going ahead and doing what they're doing anyway. I was always astounded that somebody like Joe Biden could be president of the United States. I thought, is this the best that the Democrat Party can come up with?
God,
is this all you can find as a front? But they don't care now. In the past, the politicians were slick. They were well-spoken. They looked like they meant something. They were all actors, of course. This man can't even put on a good act. And
no,
they don't
care. They're laughing at us, Frank. They're just laughing at us. They don't care
anymore.
And
the puppet masters do not care.
No, it's in our face. They're just rubbing it in our face.
Just rubbing it in our face. And an example of that, now, you asked for something around the rough edges. Well, that is tomorrow's national holiday. It's called Juneteenth.
Oh, God.
And it
help
is
us.
Now known as National Independence Day. Matter of fact, the National Independence Day Act was passed into law by this man, Joe Biden. It's a federal holiday in 2021. It's been a federal holiday ever since then. Now,
so is tomorrow a federal holiday?
Day,
is that what you're saying? Tomorrow is a federal holiday.
Tomorrow is Juneteenth. This is completely artificial. It is not just an artificial construct. It is a racist lie. It is based on a total, complete falsehood, a series of falsehoods, has absolutely no historical foundation whatsoever, and is openly racist. July 4th is our Independence Day. That is not a racist holiday. That is the celebration of the construction of the United States, our true freedom. But it is now known Juneteenth, which supposedly is meant to celebrate the end of slavery in the United States, is considered a National Independence Day. In other words,
wow.
July 4th is not. You can. I made a kind of an interesting little, teeny little discovery today on my calendar, which I got from the bank, as many millions of people do. That's how we get most of our wall calendars. Mm-hmm. Juneteenth, which is the National Independence Day now, is emblazoned in bright red on my calendar. But when I go to the next month, July 4th, mm-hmm. that day is not emblazoned. It's just as a regular black number. This is part of the minimalization and the deconstruction of all of our assumed traditions, all of our assumed foundations. So now this is being made over into this. Mm-hmm. And it is an enormous disgrace. The disgrace is not that these people are doing this because they're just malfunctioning psychopaths. Anyway, the disgrace is that no one is talking about it, that no one is opposing it. That's where the disgrace really lies. And it's based on an official narrative. And the official narrative is that the white people of the South enslaved the black people until Abraham Lincoln became the moral conscience of America. And he waged a war of liberation, of emancipation, and that all of the followers, his followers in the Union Army, went to free this enslaved people, enslaved Americans in the South. That is the narrative that this is based upon. And it celebrates Juneteenth, celebrates the Emancipation Proclamation. The Emancipation Proclamation was first proposed by Lincoln in 1861 during the war, and it was finally completely went into full effect on June 19th in 1865 in Texas. That's when the full Emancipation Proclamation was completely brought into existence. That narrative goes back long before the Civil War, with something that is not taught in schools. And by the way, everything I'm saying tonight is based on two books. And these two books are the best books on the Civil War I have ever read. And the reason why they're the best is they are extraordinarily researched. And they bring out things and document things that you will find no place else. And these two books are Lincoln's War by Lachlan Seabrook. The amount of detail in this book is completely revises our views of the Civil War and everything has happened since then. The other book is called The Real Lincoln by an author that's been on your show. It's a terrific author, more than a terrific author. This man is a fantastic historian, Thomas J. DiLorenzo. His book is extraordinarily readable. Both the books are reasonable, but these two books, Lincoln's War and The Real Lincoln, if you read these two books, you hardly need any more about this. This really is all.
Well, you'll understand American history. Without those two books, you really can't. You cannot understand.
I don't see how you really can, because not only do these books do a fantastic job of bringing out facts and ideas that have not been shown anyplace else, they present them in such a relative way, a relevant way. We can see it, how these same forces in history that were incubating over 100 years ago are percolating in our time. Mm-hmm. And I think that's a real service to the reader to see the continuity and the history, of our history, and to see that the basis for all these problems we're going through today come from a very specific place. And so it's up primarily on these two that I base it. One of the things
The Real Lincoln
out
was a book that changed my whole life in terms of understanding what really is going on here. You see the fraud, you see it all, or you see right through it. It's all there. The truth of that man is one of the best hidden secrets in American history.
You've put your finger on it. I think Thomas DiLorenzo sees right through all of the fraud, and he brings it out. You know, even so, I think it's good for readers to still maintain their own point of view. Lincoln is one of the most complicated figures in all history, and there are times when I can't stand reading about him, and other times I see that he did things that he even knew were wrong, but felt he had to do.
He's a very conflicted man. Yes.
He was a conflicted man. The times brought about in him some very difficult decisions. He was a human being. He made some mistakes, bad mistakes, but he also did some mm-hmm. good things. And I withhold a judgment on him,
Davis.
And I would hope that even mm-hmm. our listeners would withhold any kind of a judgment on him yet.
I wish we were talking about Jefferson Davis instead of Lincoln, but whatever.
Well, Jefferson Davis was a great man also, to be sure. That was an interesting period. It produced many great Americans,
yeah.
some evil ones too, but it was an extraordinary period. The times themselves were so difficult, they brought out the very best and the very worst in people. And
think of those monsters, butchers.
Monster. Absolute monsters, yeah. And then you have others, you know, like Stonewall Jackson, who was very compassionate for his own troops and for the troops that he captured. He's a true gentleman, a true Southern gentleman, and executed war only to get it over with as quickly as possible. So he was quite a saintly man in that regard. But what's brought out in Lincoln's War, something I had never heard of before, never come across before, and most of our listeners aren't familiar with, was the story of Anthony Johnson. Well, who's that? Anthony Johnson was this black man from Angola, way back in the early 1600s.
Oh, yes.
And he was a slave. He was a black slave.
Uh-huh.
And he later graduated.
Get ready for this, friends. This is the truth. Get ready for this. This is good.
We're talking about the 1620s now. That's a long time ago. That's early, real early American history. He became a servant, an indentured servant. Well, an indentured servant is the same thing as a slave, except that as an indentured servant, you can work to free yourself over time. And that's what
contract.
He did. He worked very hard, and he bought his way out. And what was the first thing he did after he worked his way out of becoming an indentured servant and before that a slave? He became a slave owner. This is this black man
first.
Became a slave owner. Not only did he become a slave owner, he became the wealthiest slave owner in South Carolina. And uh-huh. his slaves were of his fellow black people and of white people as well. It was legal. His son, John, for example, had 11 white slaves. Now, when Johnson became an influential man financially because of slavery, he helped to push through the legislation in the Charleston, South Carolina Diet, it was called at that time, was a state congress, to make slavery not only maintain its legality, but to also lower some of the tariffs so that he could have an even greater profit from the slavery of his own people and of others.
He went to
What's
court, as you know,
that,
and he to become the first legal slave owner in the colonies. He was the first legal slave owner, black.
He was the first one, and he was huge. He had, no one knows exactly how many he had, many hundreds of them. And South Carolina became the hub of slavery in the United States. 75% of the city's Charleston's free blacks, 75% owned slaves. North and South, 25% of all free blacks own slaves. 25% of free blacks, in other words, were themselves slaves, but after they had been freed for one reason or another or had bought out their way from being indentured servants, 25%, a quarter of them, became slave owners. That means look at this, put it in this perspective. One in every 300,000 whites in the United States own slaves. But one, and this is just before the Civil War, this is right up to 1861.
One in every 300,000 whites. I want that clear. One in 300,000 whites owned slaves before the war. Go ahead.
And in contrast to that, one out of every four blacks owned slaves.
25%.
Amazing. 5% of the Southerners, 5% of the Southerners were slave owners. 5%. That amounts to 1% of the national population. You're going to wage a war of extermination on the people because 1% of the national population are slave owners? That's insane. But that's the truth. Now, you contrast that number of slave owners in the United States and the between the United States Army and the Confederate Army. There were more slave owners in the United States Army than there were in the Confederate Army. Uh-huh. Now, the irony of all this is that these white men were fighting and dying over this non-issue of slavery, to end slavery, and they did end slavery. The Emancipation Proclamation was passed. And how ironic, the irony of this, is because we have not had slavery in the United States since 1865, and yet slavery is big business. It's huge. It's on an industrial scale. Where? In Africa, to this day. No one talks about that. No one mentions that. If people are really upset today about slavery, what a terrible thing it was that white Southerners, supposedly they all were slave owners. Many, you know, that most American children probably believe that Southerners, white Southerners, all own slaves, when it turns out that it was only 5% of the entire population that ever owned slaves. But big business in slavery today on an industrial scale is all up and down the west coast of Africa. It's also found in a large measure in Indonesia. But I don't know of any white nations that have been involved in slavery since the 19th century. And yet that's where all the flack comes from and crystallizes and concretizes on is the horrible atrocities of the white people who committed these slave crimes against a helpless black population. When, in fact, today, this is where the big industry is in Africa. So it's...
Well, it's a couple of things I'd like to add. One, just as a historical note, there were more whites captured by Muslims and put into slavery before the American Civil War than all the blacks ever brought to the U.S., the colonies, before the Civil War, and put into slavery. More whites than all the blacks from Africa who were trafficked over here by Jewish slave traders. More whites were enslaved by Muslims. Okay? They used to go up to Ireland, for example, on Muslim ships, and they'd capture as many Irish as they could. They'd bring the Irish back, and they'd never be seen again. That's just one little note. I assume you're not in favor of reparation then, Frank. These people are demanding $5 billion each in California or something for this bullshit slave reparation crap. They haven't got any of the facts. None
no.
of it. It's they all mythology.
The
no, they no. They it's all mythology. It's not just
they don't
not
need
true.
The facts. And
they're looking
even
for
if
a,
all those
a
reparations
handout.
Were if those reparations were paid. It would mean nothing. Do you think that would be the end of it? We'd all be friends.
Oh, no.
And get along.
Their children and grandchildren would garner the same rights to reparation. This is like the Holocaust. Now the children of Holocaust victims are entitled to be paid. The same thing.
Yes, I know. It's preposterous, of course. It's interesting about the Emancipation Proclamation, because that's what June 19th is supposed to really celebrate more than anything else. And yet the Emancipation Proclamation, which was issued in the midst of the Civil War, was not done for any moral reasons whatsoever. It was done, as Lincoln himself admitted, and this is in The Real Lincoln, and DiLorenzo goes into quite some detail on this, that Lincoln, until the Emancipation Proclamation, even up to it and probably afterwards, was really indifferent to slavery.
Right.
In his first inaugural address, he stated that he was had no right to abolish slavery because it was to do so would be against the law, would be against the Constitution. Then just 17 months later, he enacted the Emancipation Proclamation, which did free the slaves in the states. And this is the real turning point of American history, was the Civil War. The fact that the Civil War began and the Emancipation Proclamation, those two things were the turning points of American history and the death of the U.S. Constitution. Because the Constitution affirmed that the United States was a friendly, voluntary alliance of the states, and that any state had the right to secede at any time it wanted.
It's right there. You state people who want to organize, you can go. It's right there in the Constitution. Take it to the Supreme Court. Go. Just secede. Vote to secede and just cut it off. Cut the federal control mechanism off. Go ahead.
But when, of course, the southern states seceded, as they had every constitutional right to do, then Lincoln initiated this invasion of his own people and caused the Civil War. Then when he had the Emancipation Proclamation, until then, you see, slavery was only a matter of states' rights. The states themselves were guaranteed the choice to either maintain slavery or to abolish it. And Lincoln stressed that in his first inaugural address. It's printed in The Real Lincoln. And when just 17 months after he made that inaugural, his first inaugural address, what did he do? He passed the Emancipation Proclamation, which freed the slaves all across the United States, supposedly. From that point on, he set a precedent, in which the federal government can enforce its will on each state. So states' rights from that point on have meant nothing. And along with the loss of states' rights was the loss of our Constitution. Since then, the Constitution has just been used by different power factions to justify whatever they want. The Constitution is a dead letter. It was killed by Abraham Lincoln in the 19th century. And that is a fact. So we are no longer a constitutional republic. Yeah. We have not been a constitutional republic since 1865. That's with true. June 19th, this day that they're celebrating. What they're celebrating is the death of a constitutional America. That's what they're really celebrating.
It's a communist,
and a lot of them know
communist
it.
Holiday. Sickening is what it is.
It is.
Hey, here, now, just remember again, just to repeat, 25% of blacks own slaves. 25% of blacks in America owned slaves. One out of 300,000 whites owned slaves. Do you get it? And the first slaveholder was a black in the colonies. I don't understand how they're getting away with all this crap about reparations when it's all predicated on science fiction. It's a lie. All of it. Well, nothing new there.
It is a complete... Well, of course, they pick and choose what they want. You know, even so, even after everything I've told you, I'm all for the Emancipation Proclamation. I am against slavery. I'm not advocating slavery. I think it's an abomination. It's horrible, and it should be done. But this is the way the Marxists, the communists have always worked. They get a legitimate cause where people have legitimate grievances, and then the communists take over the leadership of those grievances and those causes and pervert them to their own points of view. That's all their own agendas. That is invariably the way that the communists have worked from the times of Karl Marx after World War I all the way up through the present day. It's a tactic. It's a ruse. But the thing about the Emancipation Proclamation is that it did not free any slaves at all. If you look into the details of the Emancipation Proclamation, as it is dissected by Loughlin Seabrook in Lincoln's War, in DiLorenzo and The Real Lincoln, you see what a complete fraud and what a total failure the Emancipation Proclamation was. Mm-hmm. For example, the Emancipation Proclamation only freed slaves in those states that the Union did not control. In other words, listen to this. This is an interesting statistic. There were, during the Civil War, while the North is fighting to free the slaves, supposedly in the South, there were 1 million black slaves in the northern states who were not affected. Their owners were not affected by the Emancipation Proclamation.
Right.
It specified that they are in the proclamation that they are not
excluded.
To be affected.
Right.
It was directed, the Emancipation Proclamation was directed entirely at the South. There were certain states that are listed in the Emancipation Proclamation. Go and read it. Where Maryland, Kentucky, and West Virginia were able to maintain their slaves. No problem, folks. And the promise was given in the Emancipation Proclamation for the state of Missouri, which was wobbling to go either to the South or the North. It didn't make up its mind entirely until it was occupied, forcefully occupied by the Union. But Missouri had it was called the 10% solution. And the Missouri 10% solution was that if you had a slave and you were supporting the Union and you paid your taxes, you could maintain his slavery. But if you were a Confederate sympathizer, then you could not be a slave owner. Then your slave was emancipated from you. It is a complete fraud. The reason why the Emancipation Proclamation was made, it was all Lincoln's idea. And the idea behind it that he had was that if I have the Emancipation Proclamation and all the slaves in the South know that they've been freed by me, they will rise up in insurrection and slaughter all of the leaders of the South. That's what Lincoln was hoping for. He was hoping for a mass slave revolt. It didn't happen. It didn't happen at all. Matter of fact, it backfired on him in the worst way. Not only was there no revolt in the South, there was no unrest, and there could have been because all of the white men were on the front line in the South fighting the Union. And the plantations were run by women and elderly people, and a revolt of the slaves would have succeeded. But it didn't happen. Why? Well, for a very good reason. One of the early critics of the Emancipation Proclamation told Lincoln, one of his advisors says, you should not pass this proclamation if you really believe in the moral integrity of the blacks, because what will happen? If you give them total freedom, where are they going to get jobs? How are they going to get food? Where are they going to live? What kind of shelter? Even what kind of clothing are they going
to
have? Because although you don't like slavery, Mr. President, at least they have work, they have food, they have a place to stay, and they have clothes on their back. You know what Lincoln said? This is a quote from him. He's referring to the blacks that are going to be freed by his Emancipation Proclamation. Quote, let them root, pig, or perish. That's what he said.
By the way, for
the
those of you who don't know, the people who would write down his speeches for history, for newspapers and publications, they had to constantly excise the N-word from Lincoln's speeches. He used the word nigger all the time. It was constant with him. And people who wrote his speeches down were always careful to excise the N-word from Lincoln's alleged spoken prose. And that's a fact, too. It's all in the
book. That's absolutely correct. Now, when he passed the Emancipation Proclamation, the effect on the North was hideous. It sparked, if you can imagine this is during the middle of the Civil War, and the Union was not doing that well at that time militarily. 200,000 men deserted because of the Emancipation Proclamation, and 200,000 men, and that's not all. Another 90,000 men fled to Canada rather than continue fighting on the side of the North.
Too bad they didn't go to the South and sign on with the Confederacy.
Well, you know who almost did that? Was the man that was in charge of the Union Armed Forces, Ulysses S. Grant. Ulysses S. Grant said that if I believed for 1 minute that I was fighting to free the slaves, I would bring the service of my sword to my enemies. How about
that? Wow,
that's a paraphrase,
that's an
amazing but that's really
quote.
Close.
It's
well,
that's
in the
good.
Book.
I got it. That's remarkable.
But it is, and this was the man that was totally in charge. Well, Lincoln himself admitted, he said that the Emancipation Proclamation was the most foolish thing that he had ever done in his entire life. He almost lost the war because of it. He had a lot of backpedaling to do.
Right.
But
well,
that is...
Our biggest loss was that war. You know, it's funny when you look at it. All right, we've got the Union and the Confederacy. The country was fragmented. Now, we're back to the same thing. The country is being fragmented. Red states, blue states. Red region, blue region. This is where they want it to go. So the country could, again, be in a similar condition. I'm not saying there's going to be a big war. I don't think the American people have it anymore. But that could happen politically.
Well, we don't know what kind of a generation the next one will be.
That's Generation Alpha. Those are 13 years and younger. Gen Z is worthless, useless. Now, here's just a couple more things about Nietzsche. This is important. Where did my page go here? Hold on a second. There is a piece of music that I used to listen to before Stanley Kubrick put it in his film, 2001. Also sprach Zarathustra. Thus spake Zarathustra. That's a big piece of writing by Frederick
Richard Strauss.
Richard Strauss orchestrated it to a symphonic poem, otherwise known as a tone poem.
Right.
It was 1896, it was premiered. The actual book about Zarathustra was written by Nietzsche in 1883, 1885. So about 10 years after the novel was finished, Strauss had been so inspired by it, he concocted this 33 or 34 minute piece of music that is magnificent. The whole thing's magnificent, especially the ending. I mean, everybody knows the beginning with the big bars that come in and they're portentous and all that. It's all been commercialized and overused, unfortunately. I was listening to that as a little kid before, and when I saw it in the movie, I was amazed it took somebody so long to figure out that this is one hell of a piece of drama to start a movie with. Now, that said, Nietzsche said a lot of very interesting things. Let me read a few quotes of this great man, Friedrich Nietzsche, Nietzsche. "It is not a lack of love, but a lack of friendship that makes unhappy marriages." Oh, is he right? No, and we say this now. Your best friend is supposed to be your spouse, right? People get married for reasons of hormones and all the rest of that crap, and they quickly dissipate, and you're stuck with somebody you don't even know. Mm-hmm. All right, he said that. He said, "That which does not kill us makes us stronger." He was the one who said that. "I'm not upset that you lied to me. I'm upset that from now on, I can't believe you." I can't trust you.
Yes.
And then he said, "And those who were seen dancing were thought to be insane by those who could not hear the music." And then about music, which I have always believed, even without knowing Nietzsche said anything about it, "Without music, life would be a mistake." Just extraordinary quotes. You don't have to buy into these, but this is a man in the 1880s. This is how he thought. "It is hard to remember my opinions without also remembering my reasons for them."
Mm-hmm.
"And whoever fights monsters should see to it that in the process he does not become a monster. And if you gaze long enough into an abyss, the abyss will gaze back into you." And one more. "There is always some madness in love, but there is also always some reason in madness." Great thoughts. Great thoughts.
Yes. Well, I advise our listeners, if they find those interesting, they go to a section of Thus Spake Zarathustra called the tarantulas. And if you read that section, you'll know just what's going on today and who
it's
the tarantulas
the
are.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Same
well,
plan.
I've got
to, same, okay. same thing. Same group. It's always the same people.
I found some, if you don't mind, I could have some quotes, too.
Go
this
ahead.
This is from Lachlan Seabrook's Lincoln's War. And this is this quote from Abraham Lincoln during his first inaugural address. He says, "I have no purpose, directly or indirectly, to interfere with the institution of slavery in the states where it exists. I believe I have no lawful constitutional right to do so, and I have no inclination to do so." 17 months later, he passed the Emancipation Proclamation. I mentioned earlier that U.S. Grant had some really cogent things to say about that, too. When there, even before the Emancipation Proclamation was passed, there was scuttlebutt in the Army that the president was getting ready to do that. And Grant had to issue a statement to his men to calm their fears because he believed that such a thing would never be brought out. He says in this statement, "The sole object of this war is to restore the Union," Grant said. "Should I be convinced it has any other object, or that the government designs using its soldiers to execute the wishes of the abolitionists, I pledge to you my honor as a man and a soldier. I would resign my commission and carry my sword to the other side." That's a powerful statement to make, especially coming from one of the most powerful men in the world at that time, head of the Union forces. And I think that if these men are allowed to speak for themselves, as in fact happens in these two wonderful books, I think history really comes alive. It doesn't sound like something from the dustbin of past memories. These are and were living human beings that formed what our country is today and what we're going through. Here are just a few quotes from Lincoln himself. Again, just before, not too long before the Civil War began. These are public statements. He said, this is Abraham Lincoln, "What I would most desire would be the separation of the white and black races, Negro equality, fudge. How long in the government of a God great enough to make and maintain this universe shall there continue to be knaves to vend and fools to gulp so low a piece of dogmatism as this?" And this from the great emancipator. Well, we don't hear quotes like that too often. There were a great many more. What's mostly unknown, and I think of really decisive importance, is that Abraham Lincoln was a major proponent of the Back to Africa movement. He believed in repatriation all the way up until the day he died. Just 48 hours before he was murdered, he was making arrangements with his Secretary of the Navy, in which he said that if we win this war and we have enough ships left, that rather than selling them off or dismantling them, let's use our ships to gather up all of our black Americans and repatriate them to Africa and build cities for them over there. He was talking like this all the way up until the day he died. So this doesn't quite match Steven Spielberg's vision of Lincoln in his movie, and it certainly doesn't match what we're told, how we're lied to in the textbooks that are used to school our children.
Yeah. Terrible. Here, let me do this, if I might. Then we'll come back and finish with this. This is really important material. The Grant statement is, I didn't know that. I'm learning something today.
That is in the Seabrook's book, Lincoln's War.
That's one of the most well-hidden quotes of all. Here's now, all of you know the opening of Also Sprach Zarathustra. You just do. Here's the ending. I'll give you a minute and a half. I just want you to understand. Listen to the whole thing. It's really a remarkable piece of music. There's no one alive now who can compose music like this. You got over 100 musicians in a large orchestra. Richard Strauss composed this. And this came from the mind, came from the heart, but I think more than that, it actually came from the universe, some of this music. It was so big and so magnificent. We have nothing today, nothing like it. It can't happen. We are not that kind of people anymore. All right, here's the end. This is just a minute and a half. Stop it there, but do listen to that. It's on a good stereo system, and imagine being at a concert hall in the 1890s when there was no TV, there were no movies. This was the primary form of artistic endeavor and entertainment, and it was huge. When you were in that concert hall and you were completely absorbed in this, it was, well, people were intellectually far different then than they are now. Now, what is there? Rap, rote, and watching the screen. And that's reality for people. But a big orchestra, it used to be every city in America had at least one classical music station. It's all gone. All gone. Go ahead, Frank.
You're absolutely right. There's, of course, the problem of short attention span these days. It's hard to imagine an audience filled with even young adults sitting for an hour or two listening to music like that. That piece of music you played was particularly cogent because what it portrays in sound is the story of Zarathustra, who tried to save his fellow human beings. He's comes down after having spent a great deal of time on a mountaintop. And everything seemed clear to him, and he saw simple ways in which people could finally overcome their extinction, is what he saw. He foresaw them just being something that was going to be bypassed by evolution, that human beings were, man was a rope stretched across an abyss, he said. And so the piece of music portrays Zarathustra coming down and trying to convince his fellow human beings to put aside their pettiness and to concentrate on their greatness and on their survival and the things they need to preserve themselves, their self-preservation. Mm-hmm. And they wouldn't listen to him, and they bickered among themselves, and he got weary of it all, and the music portrays him going back up into his mountain.
He walked away.
He just walked away. He tried, and he could not get through to them, and so he just goes back up to the mountain again. So that's pretty powerful stuff, especially if you put it in what's going on today.
Overlay it
there is
today?
Yes.
Oh, yes.
There's another really terrific quote from Lincoln. Again, here are these men speaking to us, not just to their own time. Lincoln says, "My enemies pretend I am now carrying on this war for the sole purpose of abolition." Well, isn't that interesting? He says, "My enemies pretend I am carrying on this war for the sole purpose of abolition." These people, in other words, what he's saying, what Lincoln is telling us, is that the people today that are saying that Lincoln carried on the war to free the slaves were his enemies. He considered them his enemies. He says, "So long as I am president, it shall be carried on for the sole purpose of restoring the Union." If there be those who would not save the Union unless they could at the same time destroy slavery, I do not agree with them. My paramount object in this struggle is to save the Union, and is not, and not either to save or to destroy slavery. If I could save the Union without freeing any slave, I would do so. So when you read these quotes, you think, like, why on earth was the Civil War even fought? What could have started it? Why were these people involved in the millions on both sides, either in the direct fighting or supporting it, trying to exterminate each other? And it was a war of extermination, like you mentioned, Sherman's march to the sea and things like that. It was a truly existential conflict.
Tell our listeners how many.
If they weren't fighting over slavery, what were they fighting over? Well, the same old thing, money. Mm-hmm. Because what had happened by the 1860s, 1861, is that the United States government was on the verge of bankruptcy. And the reason why it was on the verge of a bankruptcy were for two reasons. One, the government had gotten huge, enormously big, and padded, and corrupt. Tammany Hall and so forth, we've all heard about those 19th century escapades. The United States government was on the verge of bankruptcy, and the only way that they could save themselves, we're talking about the politicians and the corrupt statesmen, was to raise incredibly high tariffs on the South, because the South was not on the verge of bankruptcy. On the exact opposite, the South was prospering. The South was incredibly rich. Almost all of our millionaires were in the South. The average income of the average Southerner was far above the worker in the North. And so the only way was to raise tariffs inordinately high. Mm-hmm. And that's what caused such friction. The South said, we can't afford to pay this, and this is extortionist. So we're getting out of here. We're leaving. And Lincoln said, "Oh no, you're not." And there are extensive quotes from him in his cabinet meetings, in which he says, "We must not let the South go, because it will mean the end of the Union. It will disintegrate, not because other states are leaving, but because the North will be out of cash." The North had spent itself out of was spending itself out of existence. And when the war ended and the North won, the first thing they did, they confiscated the equivalent, and here Seabrook talks about it, the Union forces equivalent confiscated the equivalent of $4 billion worth of properties from the South. This was the Reconstruction. That was just that's just for openers. That's just how it started. In other words, the Union, as soon as the war was over, plundered the South. Absolutely plundered it. Yeah. And that $4 billion, that was just a down payment for what was coming. And the South has never recovered to this day. Never.
One wonders
we have
if
suffered
the South...
worse than that. Our very best racial stock on both sides obliterated themselves.
Frank, how many were killed?
Our best blood, the best American stock in the South, the best American stock in the North, mutually murdered each other, and we're left with a bunch of slobs and morons. The genetic level of America began to plummet thanks to the Civil War. That's why we have millions of morons voting for Joe Biden, because they're substandard. That's why our intellectual levels are lower, because that was a bloodletting. That was a genetic catastrophe for America.
It was a ritualized sacrifice. And we lost almost close to 700,000 dead Americans, boys for the most part, young men. 700, it's 608, I don't know what it is. Nobody knows for sure, but it's close to 700,000. It's unbelievable.
As high as those numbers are, they are multiplied especially by conditions in the South of famine and starvation that took place. But the most, the key factor, really, historically, was the loss of men who volunteered, always the best volunteer to fight for ideals. The cowards, the slackers, the ignoramuses, they are the ones that will not volunteer for high ideals or risk their lives for an idea. Those men, those 700,000, they were of that higher caliber, and that was our horrific loss. That's why we could, why we now have men like Biden and creatures like Kamala Harris, is because they're all that's left genetically of what happened after that catastrophe. That, and that is why I say the Civil War was our real turning point, and it's going to be extremely difficult to turn back from that. You can trace all of our descent into hell from that period, before America was a different place, just like after the imposition now of Juneteenth, America is going to be a very different place, unrecognizable. And we'll see how much of that good stock is left in the future. Wow. And they'll have to do what needs to be done.
Well,
but it was great discussing these things with you, and I'm very grateful for the opportunity.
Well, we thank you for sharing that. We have much to think about, and I hope you all listen to this hour again and spread it around. There's so much that you'll never understand unless you are fortunate enough to listen to people like Frank and others out there, and there aren't that many others who are willing to stand up and bring reality to us all. Thank you, Frank. That was terrific.
Well, you're one of them, that's for sure. And thank God for you and people like Seabrook and DiLorenzo. So there are still some of us left.
All right. Okay, my friend. You be well. Thank you.
Be well, too. We'll see you next month.
Okay. This is a very important hour for you. Okay. We'll pause and return.